We know there are times where you're just too busy to sort through the mass of information that comes your way. So to make it easier for you to stay informed, subscribe to The Morning Agenda, WITF's news podcast, where the only agenda is you.
Funding for The Spark is provided by Capital Blue Cross, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Cross Connect Health and Wellness Centers, which provide in-person services and inspire healthy living. Learn more at capitalbluecross.com. The Spark is also supported by UPMC. Choose UPMC for your family's health care needs close to home. Visit upmc.com/centralPA for a complete list of services and locations.
Dozens of coal plants have closed in Pennsylvania over the last few decades as the Marcellus shale boom made natural gas cheaper. Some coal energy companies decided that new environmental regulations are too costly when they shut down. Coal plants have shut down in other places across the country because of the amount of pollution they emit that contributes to climate change. A coal plant in Centralia, Washington, that at one time produced 10% of all the energy in the state of Washington, will close for good next year. The Centralia plant was the county's largest employer and largest taxpayer. However, plans for closing the facility and what comes next for Centralia is seen as a model for transitions to other forms of energy production. State Impact Pennsylvania reporter Rachel McDevitt and WITF digital producer Jeremy Long traveled to Centralia, Washington last month, and they're here today to tell the story. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here, Scott.
Hey, Scott. How's it going?
It's going well. So how did this come about, Rachel? What were you looking for in Centralia?
So I first heard of Centralia, Washington because of a report from the Ohio Valley Research Institute, OVRI. I am like thinking of the acronym and what that actually stands for. But they put out a report a couple years ago now that compared Centralia and what happened there to sort of Appalachian counties and areas in Pennsylvania that are, you know, dealing with kind of similar challenges. The Ohio River Valley Institute, that's what it's called. They argue that Centralia is a successful model of transition, of energy transition, because of, and we're going to get into this, but their coal plant is closing. A fund was put into place to help the transition along. The investment is relatively small compared to some of the tax breaks that have been given to companies in Pennsylvania to build. And so they had looked at employment data and wage data in Centralia and found that it was doing very well, that it had, in a certain period of time, wages and jobs had grown faster there than at the national average. And so they put it up as a model and an argument for investing more in clean energy and diversifying the economy as opposed to relying on like natural gas or other fossil fuels to replace coal jobs in Pennsylvania. So that's sort of a long way. So I was interested in the report, and I just remember reading it and being like, but I wonder what this feels like in Centralia. It's one thing to look at economic data, but it's another thing to go to a place and say, is this working for you? Like, is this what you wanted? Does this feel good? So that was where my interest in Centralia was. And it seemed like it had, after doing some initial reporting, like it did seem like there were some lessons there that Pennsylvania could maybe take away.
And we're going to talk about those lessons in just a moment. Jeremy Long, one of the things that you did, one of your duties on this trip was to take photographs and videos, and you are a digital producer, so putting a lot online. But visually, how would you describe Centralia?
Oh, I think it's a beautiful town. It felt like a lot of rural cities in Pennsylvania. Like it felt like one of those towns where you have a main street with businesses on both sides, and you go back a block or two, and then it's just homes. Everyone was really friendly. It's very beautiful out there too. A lot of tall pine trees in even in town. Like it's not a lot of developed in town. There's still a lot of that old growth. Pine trees, and then you just drive outside of town a little bit and you get into the woods. And that was one of the things I think was interesting. We were driving out to the coal plant the one day, and like you just come out through these pine trees, and then it's just this big open space where the coal plant is and then the former mine used to be, and it's just a kind of just an all open area. You can see what it used to be like, and then they're in the process of reclaiming that, so it will, some of it will be forest, some of it will be new industry. So it was a great time to be out there. It was really pretty, and unlike the Pacific Northwest, I don't think we experienced any rain while we were out there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we were lucky.
So just to give some context, mm-hmm. where is Centralia in relationship to, say, Seattle, where many people would be familiar with?
So Centralia is about halfway between Portland, Oregon, and Seattle. So we were about an hour and a half south of Seattle.
Okay. So, you know, we've all traveled through the coal regions here in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Visually, or maybe not even visually, but how does it look compared to, like, the coal regions of Pennsylvania?
Like I said, I think it felt very similar. You had, besides, like, we don't have a lot of pine trees in our forests here. They had a lot of pine trees around. But, like, again, you have, there is that poverty there where they had these good-paying jobs and they started to leave. So, you know, you have some houses that aren't the shiniest or prettiest, but, I mean, that's just part of the situation. You have some homes that are in the process of being rehabilitated because there is new money coming in or new people are moving in. So, like I said, I felt like there were a lot of similarities between the coal region there and the coal region here.
But one difference, though, that you just mentioned is that the population is growing in Centralia, Washington, where in many of the coal towns in Pennsylvania, the population is not increasing. So, Rachel, the coal plant in Centralia, Washington was polluting. How much? Give us a sense.
So, the local newspaper, the Centralia Chronicle, reported that it was emitting an annual average of more than 9 million metric tons of carbon dioxide every year for the first decade of the 2000s, between 2001 and 2009. That's according to statistics provided by the plant owner TransAlta. That's big. It's hard to visualize.
It is hard to visualize.
But
yeah.
Those emissions equal more than 2 million gas-powered cars driven for 1 year. So imagine almost 2.5 million gas-powered cars on the road. That's how much pollution came out of that plant in 8 years, 2001 to 2009.
A little more context. It was the biggest polluter in the state of Washington.
It was, yes.
Mm-hmm. But they did make efforts over the years to try to make this plant cleaner. Were they successful?
Yes, I think they were successful. But the pollution that they were most concerned about cleaning up is that are those pollutants like nitrogen oxide and sulfur dioxide, things that have sort of a direct health impact for people breathing in nearby. Mercury was one of the pollutants that they put some more controls on the plant for. So they did reduce those co-pollutants that come from burning coal. They put on a scrubber system in about 2000-2001, and then they added mercury controls I think around 2012-2013. The state mandated some of those cleanup things, and the companies, you know, agreed to do it. And there were two companies, so, you know, a previous one and now the TransAlta. So TransAlta put a lot of pollution controls on the plant. It doesn't really affect the amount of carbon dioxide that's being emitted, though, and that's the climate pollutant.
This was the largest employer in the county where Lewis County is. Is that what it is?
Lewis County. I'm not actually sure if it was the largest employer. And it depends on what point you're talking about, because, you know, at one point, TransAlta and the company before it owned a mine that employed 600 people, and then the plant, which employed 300 people.
Mm-hmm. And the mine closed.
The mine closed in 2006. Perhaps as a single employer, I think it would have been one of the largest, but it was a moneymaker.
The largest taxpayer to the local school district
It's a major. People kept characterizing it as a major employer and a major taxpayer.
Right. The point I bring up is there is a lot at stake. Many people will focus on how dirty the plant was, mm-hmm. the pollution. But people were employed there. It mm-hmm. was a large taxpayer. So there were a lot of people who had a stake in this.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found that was unique in your reporting, and one of the reasons I think you went to Centralia, is that there was some cooperation.
Yeah.
The people seemed to work together in the town, and opposing interest everywhere else, or a lot of places, worked together to try to find a solution, to come up with a solution. But it all started with a task force that was appointed by the governor, right?
Yeah. So we should be clear that the political situation in Washington is different than what it is in Pennsylvania. The state was, and I believe still is, controlled by Democrats. And environmental groups have a lot more sway in Washington state. Environmental groups and Democratic lawmakers were trying to pressure this plant to fully close. The governor at the time, Christine Gregoire, could see the tension sort of coming from this. Apparently there were, you know, big demonstrations. People would descend on the state capitol there, with environmentalists on one side, you know, labor groups and the coal company and people that support, you know, the energy industry on the other side. And, you know, there was a lot of tension, and this had been building. So in 2011, she put together this task force. She's like, we need to come up with a compromise. So she brought together environmental groups, the plant itself, labor groups, and people from her office. And really, it sounded like it was a tight group that did a couple days, like 2.5 days of negotiations, and worked out the language that the plant and the government eventually agreed to.
Which was closing the plant, right?
Closing the plant by 2025. And so environmentalists had been pushing for it to close, you know, much earlier, by 2015 at the latest. They agreed to delay that. Some new environmental controls would be put on for the mercury emissions. The plant would be allowed to continue, be allowed to produce power, to operate without any additional regulations. They would be able to keep the tax credits that they were claiming for those pollution controls and for burning coal from Wyoming, which is slightly cleaner than the coal that was being mined in Washington. And because the company had that longer off-ramp, they agreed to pay $55 million into a transition fund, which would then be given out as grants to the community. Some go statewide to help bridge this gap.
Rachel, I just want to highlight something you just said. The factors that went into making this a success so far. We'll talk about whether it's successful mm-hmm. a few
yeah,
years down the road. Yeah, yeah. But that cooperation, mm-hmm. I mean, I just have a hard time picturing environmental groups sitting down with the union, with the governor's office, with the plant owner, and everyone cooperating. So that cooperation seemed to be one of the keys. But that $55 million transition fund that the plant owner put up, you don't hear of that very often.
Yeah, that's why this was so interesting and that I wanted to go look at it. The cooperation, I think, in some sense, you know, is a little forced, right? Because the legislature... This had come up before in the legislature, and you know, I guess they couldn't get a vote through that would have just immediately shut down the plan or shut it down very quickly. So there must have been some bipartisan opposition to just a full out closure. But Democrats controlled the chamber. When we spoke to a former Republican lawmaker, he had been the minority chair, and you know, I asked him during the interview, I'm like, you were the Republican leader, and he's like, yeah, but in Washington we just call it the minority leader. He knew kind of how that vote was going to go. You know, he could fight as hard as he wanted to and maybe delay it. But if he wanted to get a good deal in place for the people he worked with and for the community that he lived in, he knew he was going to have to work across the aisle.
And he accepted climate change, right?
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can't say that, make a blanket statement that all Republicans don't accept it, but sometimes
right.
it put the priority on the economic and the energy considerations.
Mm-hmm.
But that Republican, that minority leader, I mean, he brought up climate change, right?
Yeah. And again, just the climate in Washington, the political climate is different. You know, it's, you know, you're more... And this former Republican lawmaker, you know, he said, he's like, I'm one of those Republicans that people might call a rhino now. You know, people might not see me as aggressive enough or, you know, extreme enough on that side of the aisle because he has, you know, worked with other people. He sort of can see it from the other side. But yeah, I think in Washington State, the climate is such that people sort of know the reality of climate change and they listen.
Jeremy, you were telling me that there was one gentleman who worked in the plant for a long time that many people pointed to as a key. What was his role?
Yeah, Bob Gunther. He's president of the Thurston. Rachel, you're going to have to
remember. He's a labor leader. Yeah. He was working for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers at the time that this deal got put through, and he used to work at the plant.
Yeah, but almost everyone we talked to on both sides, the former Republican lawmaker, the environmentalist, they said Bob was so key into getting this deal in place. And he told us, like, one of the things he did was he took the environmentalists for a tour out to the plant and gave us the same tour, kind of just an exterior tour, showed us everything that's going on out there. And he kind of seemed that said that's kind of when it clicked for that, the environmentalists saying, oh, we can't just shut this plant down. Like, there's a lot of people depending on this. There needs to be some sort of transition. And that's when people kind of seemed to say that's when it was, you know, this started to move a little bit easier towards this transition plan.
So we talked about the cooperation, talked about the money, the transition money, $55 million. The company seems, I don't know, they're in a cooperative mood too. This TransAlta, I have to admit that I wasn't familiar with them.
They are Canadian. So
oh, are they? Okay.
Yeah, very polite.
but TransAlta indicated that they wanted to keep supplying energy. Mm-hmm. Even once the plant was shut down, right?
Yeah, I think they're still looking at their options. I think that they had looked at natural gas. Natural gas is not nearly as economic in Washington State. It's much more expensive there than it is here. So I think they had looked at natural gas. That wasn't going to happen. They have a partial ownership of a wind energy farm that is up on a ridge behind the coal plant right now. So, I mean, in that sense, they will still provide energy to the region. And be present in that area, but they don't have any details at this point, really, of how they're going to continue. But they are hoping to stay involved.
This $55 million transition fund, what did it go for?
It went to three buckets. So there was a weatherization energy efficiency fund, a community and economic development fund, and a new energy technology fund. And so what that means is the weatherization went to shore up buildings, homes to, you know, reduce energy bills. That's kind of things like replacing old furnaces with electric heat pumps that are very efficient, putting in insulation, new roofs, things like that. Community and economic development can really go to a wide range of things. A lot has gone to education and sort of building up that new workforce. And then energy technology, some things have gone to sort of feasibility studies. Some things have gone for sort of concrete purchases like electric buses for the transit agency. And the big thing sort of people are focused on now is hydrogen. So some money has gone towards purchasing I believe it's like a modular, small hydrogen electrolyzer. And that's basically a machine that takes water, uses electricity to split it into oxygen and hydrogen.
We're calling this success. We also called it a model for what other places can do. But it's yet to be seen whether this will be a success as history looks at it, because there are some concerns. Not enough power in the future on peak days. They're wondering without that power plant whether, you know, on a hot day in July, I don't know how hot. Well, remember a couple of years ago, it got 110
degrees. Yeah, they can get the heat domes.
Yeah, they really can. And so far, no large-scale employer has decided to move to Centralia, right?
Right. Yeah, that's one of the drawbacks that some people have talked about. You know, they didn't land, you know, the big employer that's going to replace all these jobs, but they are hoping that with hydrogen and other industries that some direct jobs will be created in energy, and then a lot of those sort of support jobs, you know, people that, you know, supply the plant with different things. Contract work and stuff like that. It's, let me be clear, I'm not calling it a success. I'm not calling it a model. I'm calling it an example. Other researchers and such have held it up as a success or a model. But part of solutions journalism is trying to look at what a solution has done for a community and if it can be replicated somewhere else.
All right. So what can Pennsylvania learn from that?
Well, Pennsylvania should probably take away that It's important to diversify your economy. It's important to have community buy-in. It's important to have a plan and to not just and to compromise, really, to be able to work with people across political divides and across industries to figure out what is actually going to be best overall for the people in a community. I think that's the takeaway.
In 30 seconds or less, and I hate to editorialize, but it would seem like that cooperation in Pennsylvania would be one of the biggest challenges.
I think it would be tough. Labor and environmental groups in Pennsylvania, especially recently, have sort of been pitted against each other. And so I know that Governor Shapiro is trying to marry the two, industry, sort of industry and environment. But there's still a lot of opposition to that, a lot of ties to natural gas. It's much more important to our economy than it is in Washington. So it could be tough.
Rachel McDevitt is reporter for State Impact Pennsylvania, WITF's digital producer Jeremy Long. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.